will call the meeting to order. Do we have a quorum?
Yes.
We have a quorum, so I can call the meeting to order. And Representative Hilstrom, would you move approval of the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Hilstrom moves approval of the minutes for March 21st. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Norton. I will move House File 990 for Representative Norton for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee. Many members here heard your wonderful testifiers in the policy committee, so we just need an abbreviated version of this with no financial cost. So, Representative Norton.
Chair Garling and members, you have indeed, most of you heard this before, so I'll make it very brief. This is indeed a requirement for school districts to include a parent involvement policy in their set of policies. It sets up a framework, if you will, on items 1 through 6 of what that policy might look like or the provisions that should be included in the policy, but gives total control to the local school board as to what that policy will look like. It does have provisions that an advisory committee work on that policy. And I've been working with Minnesota School Boards Association, and they have two suggested changes, which if you would accept a verbal amendment.
Oral amendment.
Norton,
tell us your oral amendment. I will move the oral amendment, and it is?
Under effective date, if you would strike.
Representative Norton, tell us the line.
2.7.
Okay, 2.7. Okay, go ahead.
Is effective for and strike the remainder of that line and add January 1st, 2008.
Okay.
And I have one additional word.
Okay. Thank you. Members, this is the amendment that I'm moving on line 2.7, the second side there. Strike everything after effective and on through line 2.8 and then insert January 2008. So this section is effective January 1st, Mr. Crow tells us would be good to have in here, January 1st, 2008. And Representative Norton, why do we need this change?
Madam Chair and members, the Minnesota School Board Association felt that because this would require an advisory committee to do the work, that they thought school districts should have some time, and summer not always being the best time to work on policy, that they could use a little extra time to get the task force together, do the research, and provide a policy.
Okay, all in favor of this oral amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Norton, to your bill.
There was one other word change which we missed, and it's changing on line 1.23, and I apologize, I don't think I was clear in my statement. The advisory committee must, and it, Minnesota School Boards Association, and I've agreed, would read should.
Okay, Representative Norton, I'm just going to incorporate that into my earlier amendment. So on line 1.23, instead of must, it will state should. Okay, anything else to say about your bill?
Absolutely not, except that if we're going to improve student achievement in this state, one of the ways to do this is to get parents involved.
I've had a lot of emails on this. I'm willing to guess other members have as well. Any questions from the members? Any? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, does the School Boards Association have a model policy in regard to parent involvement? Because we've been talking about this for a lot of years. Former Representative Ellison had a piece a few years ago. So I'm just wondering if they are ready to provide school districts with some model policy language.
Representative Norton.
Chair Garling and Representative Erickson, I've served on the school board for 8 years, and I can very safely answer that they do not yet have a model policy, but when this law is enacted, they will get right busy and work on one.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Any other questions? Any testimony for or against from the audience? Okay, hearing none, House File 990 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you very much.
Is Representative Slawick here yet? I know that there's a shortage of interpreters today, and as soon as she gets here, we want to get her bill in so the interpreter can go to another committee. But I do not see Representative Slawick. So, Representative Hilstrom, are you ready to do your bill?
Sure.
Taking that, Chair. Have you heard that this needs to go anywhere else?
Madam Chair.
State Government Finance Representative Hillstrom.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I would move that House File 1160 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance.
Representative Hillstrom moves House File 1160 be recommended to pass and re-referred to State Government Finance. Staff has just reminded us that we need to go to finance and then Mary Murphy's committee?
Yes.
Okay. To Education Finance, Representative Murphy's committee, and then they will re-refer it on. So we'll just change that motion, Representative Hillstrom, accordingly.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
House File 1160 was an issue that many of you have seen. The state legislative auditor has done a report stating that there are a number of issues with post-employment benefits. And so House File 1160 is an attempt to deal with this by allowing revocable and irrevocable trust. Representative Biskins has been working on this for a number of years, and I am the one who has the vehicle, I guess, that has been delegated to move this year. So I do have a testifier here who can kind of talk about the process that we've been going through to come up with this consensus.
Welcome to the testifier. Mr. Deans, please restate your name.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. I've been delegated today to speak on behalf of the School Board Association, the League of Cities, the various county associations, and that all the groups, the government groups that have collaborated on the drafting and putting together of this legislation. In 2004, the Government of County Standards Board adopted new standards requiring public employers to disclose the total accumulated amount of other post-employment benefits for retirees. Other post-employment benefits primarily means retiree health costs. GASB 45, which is the standard that covers that, requires those employers to report and account for retiree health costs. They're not required to reserve the money. They're not required to set up any trusts. They're not required to pre-fund them. They're required to report on what the numbers are. However, it does allow them to do so. The legislative auditor's report laid out a number of reasons why you'd want to do that, to pre-fund these, so that the money would be available to pay it when those retiree health costs are need to be paid, so that it could be treated as a form of compensation, and so the current taxpayers or the current political subdivision would pay for today's costs rather than pushing it all off on tomorrow's. If you use especially irrevocable trusts, you're guaranteed that the money will be there. The concept is if you have an irrevocable trust, you'll be able to invest the money at a higher rate for a longer term, like we do with the pension plans. The firefighters' pensions, those local pension plans, where these costs are spreading out over 20 or 30 years, you can invest for those longer terms and get a higher return. To the extent that you get a higher rate in an irrevocable trust, that allows you to reduce the liability because you have that money in there from that higher rate of return, and then you have less liability because it's already pre-funded. Starting last year, or this new rule goes into effect for the big political subdivisions and for the big school districts this year. And that's why it's critical that this legislation be passed this session. We had several school districts that had gone ahead over 30 and had established trusts last year, thought that they were operating under the law as they understood it and as I still understand it. However, the Attorney General's office came with an opinion and said we did not have the power to establish those trusts so that we could comply with the national government standards, accounting board standards. This bill, while it's long and it's got lots of pieces to it, really is a relatively simple concept. The bill allows us to establish the trusts. It allows us to invest the money that is in the trusts at a higher rate, like you can do with the local government pension plans, and it validates those 30 trusts that are out there and allows them to invest that money at that higher rate. I would repeat to you, this does not require anyone to establish this trust. It does not require anyone to fund this trust. This is an accounting issue. The obligation to pay the retiree health insurance remains the same no matter whether you pass this bill or not. If we've got an obligation to pay it under our contracts or whatever, we still have to pay it. This does not change that at all. All it would allow you to do is, if we can get more interest earnings, it would allow us not to have to pay it out of money that we'd be pulling out of the classroom, but rather from the interest earnings. I can go through the bill. If you want me to, the chair suggested that I try to keep this pretty short. But let me again state that this is supported by the School Boards Association, all the county associations, the League of Cities. It has been reviewed and is incorporated in all the suggestions requested by the state auditor. And we've worked cooperatively with the state auditor on this. We've incorporated in the suggestions requested by the legislative auditor. This doesn't affect the Duluth bill, which was going on its own and has some other provisions. The state auditor has put in, and this is kind of an issue for, I think it's Representative Kahn's committee, if that's where this thing ends up, but we've got provisions that are in here that require the political subdivision to report on all the fees that are charged or all the costs of administration of this. They're all to be done the same way, so that these can be compared between political subdivisions as to the rates of return you're getting and the fees that are being charged. It's the state auditor's language. It's to ensure transparency and comparability. The state auditor also put in requirements that when these funds are invested, they are invested by professionals that do this either at the State Board of Investment or through the trust administrator by registered trust advisors, bank investment trust departments, or insurance companies, or insurance agency retirement departments that have years of experience in doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Deans. I think members probably are well aware that we need to do this if we've been following this issue. And for members who don't know Mr. Deans, if you needed a trust set up, you would want to find him or someone just like him, I think, to do it. Are there any questions? Oh, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm going to be very short because this is, and I apologize for not reading this bill beforehand, and I do have some serious questions, as I did with Representative Huntley, that I didn't ask him on the House floor. There are certain school districts that are, even municipalities that are doing levies to take care of some of their post-retirement benefits that they, some of the liabilities you ran into, and I will ask my questions later after I read the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Heidgerken. Are there any members of the audience who wish to testify for or against the bill? Any other questions? Okay, Representative Gilstrom removes her motion that House File 1160 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Education Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gilstrom. Mr. Deans. Is Representative Slawick here yet? No. Okay. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I would like to move that House File 665 be
laid over
for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill.
Representative Dietrich moves House File 665 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Honorable Bill. Members, this is a policy bill that has been in the Transportation Finance Committee most of the session. And we just became aware that it wasn't seeming to be heard there, and so given time constraints, we have to get it to ourselves because we need to hear it. And this is something that doesn't excite a lot of us a lot, but it's very important stuff to those who know about these things, like Mr. Lundell. Rep. Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that note, to present this bill the most efficiently and effectively that I can, I am going to pass this over to Brad Lundell, who is the who represents the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transportation.
Mr. Lundell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich. I'll be very brief here before I hand over the testimony to Dave Peterson from St. Paul. I think we'll also be joined by Jan Vanderwall from Roseville to talk about one particular provision that does deal with education finance. The reason we do these bills every few years to update our Minnesota standards to match what happens at the national standards meetings and get the Minnesota standards in you know, so that Congress with what's happening nationally. A lot of these things were before the legislature last year, but there was never a conference committee last year, and a lot of things fell out of, they were approved in both bodies, but they never really got to the conference committee because there wasn't one. And so these things, many of these things have had legislative, some level of legislative approval before, but clearly need to be looked at again. They're not that controversial for the most part, but they do require some explanation, and Dave Peterson from St. Paul is extremely well qualified to lead you through what those are. So I'll turn it over to Dave Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell, and welcome to Mr. Peterson. If you could restate your name for the tape, please.
My name is David Peterson. I'm the Communication Officer for the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transportation. We represent School District Transportation Operations. And I was here to give our support to House File 665. There's a two-page summary covering 17 sections. If you would like, I could go through the summary item by item, or I could just wait for questions.
Well, Mr. Peterson, why don't you highlight for us any that would be controversial? I think that would be what, you know, the humdrum things I think we could read for ourselves, but the ones that you or Mr. Lundell or Rep. Dietrich think we should pay attention to are the ones we'd really like to hear about. And then the onus will be on you if you didn't point out any that later we find we should have known about.
Well, Madam Chair, Members Committee, the main thrust of this bill is to update Minnesota school bus standards to national recommended standards. And we do have some other items specific for Minnesota. One thing I'd call your attention to is Section 6. Here we're proposing that school bus drivers not be allowed to be making personal phone calls on cell phones while operating school bus. This is part of a national push to prevent school bus drivers from using their cell phones while driving a bus. As we took a survey of our membership, we found situations where the cell phones are being used for operations in situations such as a through about a town or we're outside the two-way radio communication area or a weekend call when there's no dispatcher at the garage. So there are some situations where the driver needs to use a cell phone for business calls. So we worded this that school bus drivers should be prohibited from making personal phone calls while driving the school bus. Another section is the transportation cost allocation, which is
what section that is, what page or line.
That's section 3, and currently if a district contracts a bus service, they would typically have contracts so they know their contract rates for different types of service. If a district owns their own school bus, they don't have contract rates to assign costs, and most commonly a district in that situation would allocate costs based upon the miles driven. There, of course, in transportation, there's additional funding for some types of transportation, such as special education transportation. There were some contract districts that put an inordinate amount of cost into the special education category to receive more reimbursement. the Department of Education addressed this by out language and cost allocation manual where all districts would have to abide by allocating costs based upon miles. However, for a situation where the district contracts for service, they probably have more accurate costs based upon the contract rates, unless there's contracts are written in some manner to put in order amount of cost in a special area. So because the costs are more accurate based upon contract rates, we believe the district should opt out of the per mile allocation method and use the actual known costs when they're more accurate under contract rates. And then another significant area is using the multifunctional school activity bus. And this comes under Section 14. Currently, there's a law where an employee of a school district or contractor can drive a mini school bus, a Type A school bus, without a commercial driver's license, subject to meeting about 10 qualifications. The typical situation, the athletic coach would drive the kids to a athletic event in a small bus without a CDL. This program is currently in place and has been in place for about 5 years. The federal government's come out with a new definition of a school bus, a multifunctional school activity bus, that has a three-point definition. First off, it doesn't have the stop arm eight-way system that a school bus would have. Second off, it can be a different color. And third off, it can only be used for transportation on field trip type activities, cannot be used to and from school. By not having a stop arm and eight-way system, there's a cost savings for a district using one of these buses or a contractor using one of these buses. So it's the same program we have in place under current law. Only the current law is for a Type A bus that's painted yellow and has a stop arm. This would be the same vehicle without a stop arm, eight-way system, and painted a different color. And the reason for the federal government to come up with this different category of school buses, they're trying to encourage school districts to have students not transported in cars or vans, but more in a school bus type vehicle. So the federal government's kind of given the emphasis to use these kind of vehicles on an opt-in basis to improve school bus safety. Those are the items that stick out to me pretty much. I do see one under Section 12, the height of the school bus seat back. And currently seat backs are 20 inches high. The national standards recommend going to 24 inches high. Having a higher seatbelt provides better safety in case of a front-end collision where the kids are in an area that we call compartmentalized. There's a high back seat would prevent the kids from being thrown around significantly during a severe crash. Unfortunately, as the seatback height gets higher, then the school bus driver has less ability to look in the mirror and see the behavior of the kids, so then there's a loss on disciplining the kids. So we were recommending that a school district would have an option to have the seat height more for crash safety or for discipline purposes, depending on local school district question.
Okay, Mr. Peterson, is that the end of the highlights that you think we should know about?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, I would say that the one about the safety arms is definitely a highlight. I was here in my first term where we mandated safety arms after students, as maybe you remember, had been killed in school bus accidents, and that was now Congresswoman Betty McCollum's first big bill. And but then when people aren't using the school bus, then these other proposals come in. I could see this all going full circle again. Representative Heidgerken, Representative Anzels, and Representative Erickson. Representative Heidgerken.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And anybody there that wants the answer to this, Section 7, page 6, lines 6.8 is very, very major, at least I'm reading it as major, because you've taken out on the driver seatbelt, you've crossed out new, maintenance not required for all school buses and Head Start buses now to have seatbelts, and I know that is not a fact out there. There's got to be quite a bit of a cost, I would think, for all the school buses that would not be at least, I think that's major.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this particular section, subdivision 2, is driver seatbelts. So this is only referring to the seatbelt worn by the driver.
Okay.
Current law.
Okay. Yep.
Representative Heidgerken said that's good for him. Representative Heidgerken, is that your only question?
Yep.
Okay. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. Anytime the federal government starts explaining to school districts in rural Minnesota, sparsely rural districts, sparsely populated, out in the middle of nowhere, I get a little nervous, just for starters. Secondly, is there an inspection component somewhere in here that I'm missing?
No.
Is there a bus inspection piece?
Madam Chair, Representative Anzell, there's been talk of a self-inspection program, and Captain Urquhart is here today from the DPS, that it's not in this bill. This is merely a cleanup bill. That certainly goes beyond cleanup. That would be a policy change from current law, and that is not contained here.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's a good thing. Page 4, it's section C, page 4, C, lines 10 through 21. That feels to me like we're tilting toward contracting out transportation services, and in small rural districts that are remote, that may end up having some unintended costs or circumstances.
Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich.
We have Gary Bosak.
No,
you're Gary.
No, actually, this is Jan Vanderwall. I know him because he's from Roseville Area School. Mr. Bosak is behind you, Representative Dietrich.
We need a scorecard. Scorecard.
Your neighbor.
They look so much alike.
Actually, Representative Dietrich, he does live up the street from me. Welcome, Mr. Vanderwall. It wouldn't be a school bus discussion without you here. Please restate your name for the tape.
Representative Greiling, or Representative Chair, Madam Chair, I'm Jan Vanderwall, Transportation Coordinator for the Roseville Area School District. And I briefly heard the question. I'm sorry I just arrived in the room.
Would you like Representative Anzell to repeat it? Representative Anzell.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, it's C on page 4. That's included in the section 3. That talks about contracting transportation services, and I just, reading that, I have some discomfort about how that may impact small, very rural, very remote districts. Is my concern justified or not?
Mr. Vanderwall.
Madam Chair, Representative, this actually is a provision that was instituted last year by the department in order to work with to try and put an additional onus on districts that contract so that they would allocate costs similar to the allocation process that's used for districts that own their own buses. There has been some problem with some districts where they allocated costs not exactly the same as the services that were being provided, and that issue was primarily the problem of districts trying to put more money, more transportation money, into special ed costs so that they could get more revenue out of it. And when the department came at this, they decided that the way to do it was to make sure that everybody followed very specific guidelines, even if it didn't follow the way districts contracted. And districts like St. Paul are strongly as affected by this as small rural districts as well. But there is an unfairness in this, in that the few districts that were not allocating it in the most reasonable manner are found, but all districts, almost all districts, have to do a different allocation process because of this.
Representative Van Zyl.
Thank you.
More than you want to.
If I'm a school superintendent or an elected school board person and I'm in one of these small, rural, remote districts and this becomes law, it seems to me like I'm going to see mandate, I'm going to see costs, I'm going to see regulations that may impact my district in a much different way than another cluster of districts. So help me with that.
Mr. Vanderwaal.
Representative, this is already in effect, and what we are trying to do with this language is to try and ameliorate the onus that has been put on schools based on the department's actions last year to put this allocation process into effect. So this is actually a lessening of the onus.
And Representative Van Zyl and Mr. Vanderwaal, Mr. Strom will weigh in here as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Van Zyl, it may help to set the context for this provision. All this provision does, it doesn't encourage contracting or discourage contracting. What this provision does is deal with how the school district allocates the cost for contracted bus service. So, for example, if the district contracts for a field trip and the price of that bus is $400, the district can report that the cost of that trip was $400 instead of allocating on a cost per mile basis, saying, well, it's 26 cents per mile plus these other charges. So really it's a, and please, if the witnesses would correct me if I'm misstating this at all, but really it's a bookkeeping matter for the district as to how they figure out their costs. And I don't think there'd be any encouragement to either contract or district own on this provision.
Head nods, yes, we see them from the witnesses. Representative Van Zyl, is that it for you? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my main question is, Representative Dietrich, are all parties in agreement this year, or are we, like in past years, we have one bus group that has this position and the other bus group that has another position? So I guess Mr. Bostic is here to help us. Thank you.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Bostic. Is there peace in the valley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is peace in the valley, Representative Erickson. And others, I'm here, Gary Bostic, for the record, representing the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. Our members transport over 50% of the students each day. There's 13,000 buses in Minnesota. Our members, this is First Student, this is Laidlaw, these are, you know, these are some big companies. And there's a lot of small companies that are in your hometowns. But we work with MAPT, and we work well with Dave and his organization, Mr. Arbil. Some of our members raised some concerns about the multifunction student activity bus, but having conversations with Captain Urquhart in the back before this, we are not prepared to go to the mat on this issue. We think, and Madam Chair, you raised a concern about, we're talking about smaller vehicles, not picking up students, basically the speech coach is driving, the tennis coach is driving, the janitor could be driving. So we want to be, our concern is that our drivers are safe, that they're knowledgeable, they're trained. Captain Urquhart assures me, even though they don't have a commercial driver's license, a CDL like all of our drivers do, that they are going to be tested and they're going to be trained and they're going to be safe. And I think that's what we all want. So these are not type A's, they're like type A's. These are called multifunction school activity buses, and they're coming. The federal government recognizes them, and they're coming to a town near you. We just want them to be safe, and we want the drivers to be safe as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just real quickly cover a couple of things that Dave didn't.
Well, before you go on, Representative Erickson has a follow-up question.
Well, I'll wait, because I'd rather hear this first.
Okay, very good. Mr. Bostic.
Madam Chair, just briefly, the Section A of the bill talks about national school transportation specifications and procedures. Every five years, a national effort is undertaken to update and improve the manufacture of school buses. So this is moving from an old 2000 standard to a 2005 standard. So we're only 2 years behind. But we also have exceptions to school buses in Minnesota. We do certain things in Minnesota for heating purposes, insulation, and safety. So in my guys' order, our members, just like MAPT school district order buses, they can put in specific requests for their vehicle, just like you might do on a car. Our buses are probably the safest buses in the country as far as national standards, but then Minnesota standards on top of those. And so we're not adopting all the national standards. We continue to respect and enforce some of the Minnesota add-ons or the special situations, and we're protecting those in this bill as well.
Thank you. I've got Representative Erickson, Demmer, and then McFarland, and then I'm going to ask for testimony, and we'll have to press on. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Botsick, on page 10, the prohibition on Type A school bus using the 8-light system, who's going to enforce that? I realize it's a misdemeanor only, but who will do the enforcing there?
Mr. Botsick.
It's line 10.21.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, this is enforced by the Department of Public Safety, school bus safety. If I'm wrong on that, Mr. Peterson, correct me? He's nodding. So that is enforced by the our Department of Public Safety, Colonel Urquhart and his school bus inspectors. Madam Chair and Representative, that's a situation where you would see this on the street or on the highway.
Yes.
And they would, in effect, pull them over and ask for clarification. And you can imagine it's not done every day. So that's our concern, is that we're going to have some with Type A's out there, and you're going to have these multis out
right.
there, and
right.
it's getting to be quite a hodgepodge of transportation vehicles. And some of our members are concerned about that.
Trustee Erickson, are you good?
I just have one more question, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Mr. Botsick, to what extent is this going to be a cost driver now for your clients? Because on page 8, we have the minimum cushion depth now of 15 inches and a seatback height of at least 20 inches. And it looks like it's effective. Well, it is. It's effective the first of next year. To what extent is that going to be a cost driver?
Mr. Botsick.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, it's not a cost driver since it only applies to new buses. We don't have to retrofit. You have to order your new buses to meet that definition. And that leaves in compliance vehicles that are already in operation. They're in effect grandfathered in.
Representative Demmer.
Representative
Erickson, were you done?
Well, ma'am,
that was your last question.
I'm concerned that it doesn't say new buses, but I will let the gentleman at the table figure out whether that's specific enough. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. I don't see any other questioners. Anybody in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Representative Dietrich, House File 665. Or did you have any last comments?
No, not really, Madam Chair. All I can say is that I'm just very thankful that there are people like these three gentlemen who delve into these types of issues.
You're a brave legislator to tackle this bill.
Yes.
The State Patrol is here. Do you have any comments, or were you just here to as a resource?
Madam Chair, just if you have any questions of us, we're available.
Very good. Thank you for having been here. Representative Dietrich, thank you very much, and to all you testifiers.
Thank you.
House File 665 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And is Representative Slawick here now? She is. Representative Slawick, let's take your bill that has to do with the hearing loss coordinator first.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I will move House File 1187 for possible, or 1887, for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I do have an oral amendment, Madam Chair.
Oral amendment. Tell us the line.
I will need help from staff. Page 2, line 2.18, under appropriations, that should be $160,000 beginning July 1st, 2007, for the biennium. So how we word that to be a biennial allocation, as well as line 2.22, the same thing. The $60,000 would be over a biennium as well. So,
okay, Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, which one of you wants to move? I'll move that amendment, that oral amendment, and one of them can tell us what it should say. Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair and members, should insert after. Yeah, is it 160 total? Madam Chair, strike 160 and insert 80,000, and then after 2008, insert and 80,000 in fiscal year 2009. And similarly, on line 2.22, replace 60 with 30,000 and insert after 2008 and 30,000 for 2000 in fiscal year 2009.
Okay, did everyone get that? Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Sawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Please note for the record that we just cut our allocation in half or our request, and we hope that puts us in the good graces of the chair. And this bill, and many of you have heard about this, provides a coordinated services for children that are newly identified with hearing loss. Early childhood identification and intervention is essential for their success. What this does is provide a coordinator for families and for the system that are identified with the hearing loss. Providers and parents say the system right now is very fragmented. This bill will help ensure that deaf and hard of hearing babies get the specialized educational intervention they need. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like the testifier to testify briefly about this.
Ms. Hartnett, welcome and state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Hartnett. I'm with the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People, and I'll be going through briefly through a presentation that was developed by Dr. Carl White from the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, part of the Center for Disease Control, and by Dr. Peggy Nelson, a professor and audiologist from the University of Minnesota. This was developed by stakeholders, parents. This proposal came from a grassroots effort and from professionals. We are in the middle of a revolution that's happening nationally, and Minnesota has been left behind. We are in the bottom five of states for our identification and referral of hearing loss to the Department of Health. We have 62 children that were referred last year, and based on our population, we should be identifying about 240. Of those, only 22 were reported as having a primary disability of hearing loss to the Department of Education. We need to make sure that there is coordination between the two agencies. There are two currently coordinators from the Department of Health that are working on this issue, that are coordinating early hearing detection intervention. We want a counterpart in the Department of Ed. What are the components of a good identification system? Diagnosis, screening, and key to all of this is intervention. Getting the kids the specialized services they need. If they get them and are screened by 1 month, have their diagnosis confirmed by 3 months, and get intervention by 6 months, there is no difference between cognitive development and their language acquisition. If they don't get that, they face emotional, cognitive, and language deficits that they are almost impossible for them to overcome those. The rest of the country identifies about 3 per 1,000 kids per 1,000. Minnesota right now is identifying about 1 per 1,000. This coordinator would help us to meet our federal obligations. We're supposed to be coordinating services through IDEA, making sure that kids are getting specialized services. Generalized services don't work for this population. They need focus on their language development, and they need to have that language development assessed. It's not currently happening. We currently have a coordinator that's working on K through 12 and is trying to stretch her time to attend to all of the training that needs to happen and coordination that needs to happen with birth to 5, but that isn't able to happen on a full-time basis. We're going to be going from 62 to about 200 when we get our hearing screening mandate passed. I hope our screening mandate gets passed. Currently, the department has $15,000 that is allocated a year for training. We really believe that there needs to be a bump in those. There are a number of different services or resources that we could be tapping into that we think that we're underutilizing through Medicaid for kids. There's Head Start funding that we could perhaps tap into. There's 343 school districts, 95 early intervention teams that are established statewide. But there's nobody coordinating all of this in the school districts. So we really believe that if we were to have a coordinator that would be, once the kids are identified, you know, making sure that those services are happening for these kids, we could really transform the system. We could really make and be part of the revolution that's happening in the rest of the country. I've done this for 30 years, and this is so amazing. We have, if you look at your blue sheet of paper that we've distributed, we have supports that we're trying to put in place for parents And this is all evidence-based practice. It's happening in the rest of the country. So we have a couple of bills in the Department of Human Services that will provide immediate amplification for parents through a hearing aid loaner bag. We have babies that are, within a week of being identified, getting a loaner hearing aid so they get immediate amplification of sound. We'll be having immediate exposure to sign language if parents choose that. And then with the mandate as the cornerstone and having these Part C coordinator services in place, we really would put ourselves from going from the bottom five to the top five in the country. So we really ask that you are able to support this. We have testimony from a parent who had to leave. She thought that we were on the beginning of the agenda, we were on the end. Going to be on the end of the agenda, so she wasn't able to come, but you see her testimony here. And I have just brief about less than 1 minute testimony from Cynthia Weisel.
Welcome, Ms. Weisel.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, this will be a new record for me, less than 1 minute. I don't talk near as fast as these two ladies here, but I will try to be brief and mindful. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am deaf and I am bilingual, fluent in both American Sign Language and English. And I grew up in a public school, Catholic school, actually later public. No interpreter. Back in the 60s, we didn't have support services like this. I grew up in a very rural area, way out in the middle of nowhere. My parents were very poor, single wide trailer right next to the railroad tracks. You've heard this story before. I have 15 years experience in nonprofit management and serving the deaf and hard of hearing community. I have a degree in business management and also a degree in fine art. I'm a multi-talented, multi-skilled, multi-knowledgeable person. And the reason I am where I am today is because of one thing. Since day one, since the day I was born, I had access to language. I was born with Treacher Collins syndrome, which means at the time of birth, my inner middle ear and my facial cranial bone hadn't yet fully developed. I was actually significantly hard of hearing with progressive hearing loss as I grew older. Many people ask me, on a daily basis in fact, how do you speak so well? I've been deaf actually since age 12. And I say, well, that's easy. My parents were deaf. Mm-hmm. Most people are shocked. They're expecting to hear years and years of speech therapy, this and that surgery, this and that service. My parents were deaf, so from day one, I had language. When you have language, it doesn't matter how you get it or what language it is. You can then access information, knowledge, independence, confidence, your place in the family, what's expected of you, your role, where you fit in the community, all those things come from language. Now, 90% of deaf children are born to hearing parents, and most all of those parents have no knowledge of the deaf or hard of hearing community or the support services offered by this bill. And this bill is what would help these parents to access that knowledge and information and that support that they critically need so that their children can have that luck, which for me it was purely luck, but the necessary support needed to make sure they have that language from day one. I could go on and on, but I know time is limited, so I'll stop here, and if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weisel, Ms. Hartnett. Are there any questions for these two eloquent testifiers? Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And some of the members did not hear this in education policy. I know Representative Hosh had a personal experience with this. And this is a very, very good program. I'm a lion, and I got the Helen Keller Sight Award, and we have just got involved with this program as well. We're a contributor. And I think this is any help we can give them, because there's matching grant monies coming forth from different organizations, a very, very worthwhile cause.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Any testimony for or against in the audience? Before I get on, as long as I ask, is there anybody to testify? Okay, Representative Brown.
Most of you have heard my story, so I'm not going to repeat it, but I have got to say, unless you have experienced this, you cannot understand the importance of this program. I just listened to a testifier who has a hearing loss far more profound than my son's, who was not identified as having a hearing loss until he was 3 years old, and her speech is so much greater than my son's is today at 25 years old. So I am so appreciative of our testifier coming and talking, because she is very strong evidence that the program does work and does work well. Services given at a very young age are so beneficial, and I'm hearing it from my own ears, just in the difference in her speech and my son's speech, who received no services of that kind. Not because I'm not an intelligent woman and didn't seek things out, but because, you know, when you have a doctor look at you and tell you you are a parent that's just over-concerned. This is your first child. I'm sorry, but, you know, there's nothing wrong. And therefore not get services until 3 or 4 years of age and not have coordinated services. It's a different story, and I just admire the work that has been done and the opportunities that we have and options to take advantage of right now by getting a coordinator and putting a group of services together that could best take care of our population.
Thank you, Representative Brown. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to say to the testifier, you just have a lovely voice.
She's silent in case you can't see it from the corner table, Representative Detmer. All right, well then, House File 1887 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. And then, Representative Slawick, why don't you just stay right there and do your other bill? And I will move House File 1794 for possible inclusion. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This program is called Words Work, and what we're asking for here today is for inclusion in your bill, and we're even willing to take less than we asked for, but what this is all about, it's about closing the achievement gap. When our Early Childhood Committee started out for the year, one-third of our goals is closing that achievement gap, and the way you do it with little kids is you can go to Head Start, but to get it to improve, you have to either improve the intensity or the duration. And what Words Work is about, it's about improving the intensity. So with that, I have two testifiers, and I'll let them tell you more about Words Work.
Welcome. Chair and committee, thank you. My name is Beth Menninga. I work for the St. Paul Foundation, and I coordinate the Words Work Early Literacy Initiative. And you have a handout on it in your packets, so there's lots more information there if you'd like it. This project began in 1997 through the St. Paul Foundation. We are currently working in over 40 Head Start classrooms in Ramsey County, Dakota County as well, serving over 1,300 children each year. Some of you have already heard this, so I'm going to try to keep it brief. We are moving into Scott and Carver counties next year through our partnership with the CAP agency there. We continue our partnership with Community Action Partnership, Head Start, in Ramsey County. We're hoping this bill will open the opportunity for this project to other Head Start programs in the state. Our vision is that all children will become successful readers in school, and we accomplish this by focusing on literacy-based research-based early literacy goals and respecting children's home language and culture. We include professional development for teachers, including intensive mentoring and customized training. We help teachers better understand and use assessments to set goals and help the whole program of Head Start that we're working with develop assessment systems that support the process of data-driven decision-making. We help program staff develop strategies that link those classroom goals to activities and resources and information for parents so that those goals are reinforced in the home. And we build program capacity that can integrate all the successful practices into the entire program. If you look on the opening page of your brochure, you'll find information on our longitudinal study. The foundation decided to look at the long-term impact of our project. We began the project in 1999, the school year. We looked at our children's scores on a nationally normed vocabulary test. The national norm group of students, 77% of them scored at or above average, and our students scored at 39% at or above average. Now, that fits with what research would say. Our group of children are 97% low income, 92% children of color, and usually 60 to 70% English language learners. So the research implies that they're at risk for achievement gap. We saw that when they entered Head Start. We followed them through the St. Paul Public School System and looked at their standardized achievement scores in math and in reading. Those first three groups of children, the first 3 years of Wordsworth were followed, and that first group was in fifth grade last year. We looked at their scores again compared to a national group of children, very different demographics, but we compared them nonetheless. And as you can see, again, 77% of the national norm scored at or above average. Our children did better, 86% in reading and 88% in math. We also saw continued growth curves, so there was not a fade-out effect with those children. And they also were up to three times more likely to score above average when we compared them with at-risk children with the same factors in the St. Paul Public Schools. Renee LaRoa is a Head Start teacher who works just down the road at Dahlem University with students who may be siblings of the students I just talked about. And she's going to talk about what this looks like in classrooms and for families.
Welcome, Ms. Rose.
Thank you. My name is Renee LaRoa.
Excuse me.
And I just want to let you know what an amazing program Wordsworth is. It works with both the family and the child. The impact on children is it starts with what they already know. And then we go up and up and up and up. Children who were here last year and are getting ready to enter kindergarten this year are all printing, copying letters, being able to print words. They're starting to sight read some of the words as they prepare. They're counting. They're counting to at least 30. And that is a good set preparation for them when they get into school. They all know at least 17 to 26 letters of the alphabet, where a year ago they didn't know anything. They could barely speak English. This takes a look at the group and then the individual child, and we work with both, the large group and the individual child. It really helps them. We help create conversation with them. We have we work with 8 books for the week. We work on building skills with this book. All of our lesson plans revolve around teaching vocabulary words and the meaning of the vocabulary words. It's an amazing thing. It's very intentional and very focused. And it's amazing when you see what these children are really able to accomplish. If you have time, I would really like to invite you to come down to the Ruth Benner Head Start Center where I work and see these children in action. It will just absolutely make you stop and really appreciate how fast and how wonderful children learn and how important this is.
Thank you, Ms. LaRoa. Are there questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who would want to answer my question, but I'll leave it for multiple choice. I'm always curious when I see research-based language, and knowing that for about every issue we face, we can find research for both sides as they come here and present. So as I look down on page 1, lines 16 and 17, I'm curious what labels are, and when you start to get to the level of rhyming, I'm wondering if phonics has a role in this program.
Beth Menninga. I'll answer that, and Renee could give examples too. But in early childhood classrooms, we often label what are in the classrooms that children might use. So, for example, in Renee's classroom, there might be a cupboard where the utensils are kept for the meal times, and there's those family-style meals in Head Start. And so they might have a label that says spoons and a picture of the spoons, because we're talking preschoolers here, 3 to 5 year olds. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they label certain key areas so that children start connecting the written word with the object and actually in a useful way, so they help set the table. So they would know where the spoons are, both from a visual label, but they start connecting. We do that with their names, all kinds of things. In terms of rhyming, preschoolers usually do not get into phonics. They're focusing on what's called phonological awareness, which you can do with your eyes shut. You can't do phonics with your eyes shut. It's the sound structure of language. So rhyming is one piece of that, hearing how the end of word sounds. At the beginning, alliteration, like Silly Sally is a great book with alliteration. 30% of children, and that's across incomes, in English, tend to not develop this skill. And it's one of the key predictors of reading success. That's why we include it. So rhyming is really fun for children. Dr. Seuss is a great example. So that's why we focus on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that clarification. I do know that rhyming is good, and I appreciate knowing that phonics doesn't come in then. But one thing I would say, Madam Chair,
Olson,
is now I know why when you buy a new car, it doesn't say gas, it has a picture.
It's always helpful. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to know if any of the testifiers can tell me, what does this program cost if one wants to purchase it, let's say, for a preschool on an individual basis?
Mm-hmm.
You know, not using government money, just doing it on our own.
Miss Meninga, sorry.
Is it Meninga?
Meninga.
Meninga, okay. Thank you.
We've looked at the cost because we initiated it several years ago, and over time it looks like the cost is about $500 per child. I would say the majority of that cost goes into mentoring. As you know, staffing is probably the most expensive cost in education usually, and that's very true in early childhood. Not that they get a lot of money, mind you, but the mentoring is the primary cost. There are other costs, including resources that go home to families, resources for the classroom, and other elements. The assessment piece being another.
Thank you very much. Any testimony for or against from the audience? Okay, hearing none, House File 1794 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you all very, very much.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Yes, Representative Moll. I will move House File 1383 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Moll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you taking this bill on. I'll introduce it briefly, and then I have a couple of testifiers and stamp of questions. House File 1383 is an effort to relocate the Indian Scholarship Office, is currently located in the Department of Education down here in Roseville, back to its traditional home in Bemidji, Minnesota. You'll see a handout being passed out here. I'll give it a couple minutes to get around. It's the school districts and the number of students that are American Indian. And as you look at it, the number of the districts that all have the largest number of American Indian students are all in the north. In particular, Bagley, Bemidji, Cass Lake, Bina, who won in the quarterfinals of the state basketball tournament last night.
Nice one.
Duluth, Detroit Lakes, Fond du Lac, on down the list. And the contention amongst many of the high school students, their counselors and teachers, are the access to the Roseville office is very difficult for them. Minnesota Chippewa tribe passed unanimously, and all tribal leaders who are concerned about this issue have expressed interest in having the office moved back to Bemidji. You'll see the language in front of you. We've continued to work with tribal leaders and interested parties on this bill, and in so doing, we have a couple of brief oral amendments to make to the bill in front of you to accommodate last-minute concerns from a couple of the tribes. And if you go to line 1.9, It says must maintain an office with at least one staff person. Strike at Bemidji State University and add in the Bemidji area.
Okay, we've got that one. The next part.
And then one more. On line 1.10, strike office space through all of line 1.11.
Is that it, Representative Moe?
Yes, that's it.
Okay, I'll move for Representative Moe. The oral amendment on line 1.9, striking at Bemidji State University and putting in the Bemidji area. And then line 110, striking office space and the rest of the line, and then all of line 1.11.
Correct.
Any discussion? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moe, do you have an idea of the cost of that and kind of fiscal load or anything?
Representative Demmer, are you, I think you're talking about the bill, not the amendment,
no,
right?
I'm talking about the office space.
Well, we're talking about changing the, yeah, the amendment changes this and basically changes the office space that says must be provided by Bemidji
okay.
State.
All right.
I can respond to that question,
what I read now. So.
Okay, Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, thank you for the question. Which is leading into my next point, and thank you for the segue. We're going to ask that this be located in, I think, the logical location, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, because, as you know, they administer most of our state scholarship programs. The Minnesota Indian Affairs Council also has an office in Bemidji with space that's suitable for this office, close to BSU, but also relatively close to the tribal colleges at White Earth, Red Lake, and Leech Lake. So, that was a suggestion brought to me by Chairman Visner, who you'll hear from in a minute, as a way to accommodate the interest of other tribes. So,
and Representative Moe, I think now I understand what Representative Demmer is asking, which is very pertinent to the amendment. Before it was at no cost, and now is this new office at no cost? Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, my understanding is yes, that's at no cost. I could, if, you know, if it be the will of the committee, amend my motion to retain at no cost of the scholarship program at the end of line 1.10.
Representative Moe, I will incorporate that into the oral amendment, and I'm going to repeat it again.
Okay.
But first, let's ask Representative Demmer, did that satisfy your question?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Moe, I'm not trying to create a problem, but, you know, who's going to pay for it is the question. And if we say, no, we're saying who's not going to, we aren't saying who is going to pay for staffing this office. You know, it's not an insignificant cost to have office space with equipment, have people. I'm just wondering if we're asking the Office of Higher Education to do this, and if that's in their budget, and, you know, for full disclosure of this. That's all. We're not saying who is going to pay for that, so I was wondering about
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, part of the request of this bill is to not only transfer the cost of the scholarship money itself to higher education, but there would be one full-time equivalent employee that would also be going with it. That's currently responsible for serving or for administering the scholarship office. And again, you know, there might be a few, you know, there's an office there now. There's a desk, there's a phone line, there's a computer line. I can't say that she or he is not going to need pencils or paper or any other things. I can't imagine that being a huge cost to the department, the Indian Affairs Council, but it's not totally insignificant, but it's it perhaps would be a real cost.
Well, and now, Representative Demmer, and we are going to try to finish. We have four more bills, so this will be your last question. Representative Demmer.
Well, Madam Chair, the Office of Higher Education basically is being asked to install an office up at Bemidji State at their cost. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to hear from them and see if they're aware and see if it's in their budget or not. It's easy to say, well, I don't think it'd be very much, but they can pay for it. I mean, they have a right to know that they're being asked to do this, which I'm assuming since it's an amendment that they don't know, and I'd be interested in hearing what their thoughts would be about this as they administer their programs and try to coordinate their budget.
Is there anyone here from Minnesota Office of Higher Education?
I can speak to that wherever we can.
Representative Moe.
Yeah. Pardon? Thank you, Madam Chair. I've spoken with Susan Niegard. Thank you for the correction. And she is aware that this is the intention. She had a couple of concerns that we've talked through. She would expect that they would have authority over the scholarship office if they're going to be held accountable, which they would be. They would want to administer it in a way that would be consistent with the way in which they're administering other scholarships. So she knows full well that this legislation is going forward and has no, and her office officially has no position.
Okay, members, we're going to vote on the amendment now. We're going to have to finish up this bill, or if it runs into trouble, we're going to have to postpone it, put it to the... I have to get my three bills passed today.
Sure, thank you.
And Representative Hornstein is on the agenda as well. All in favor of the amendment, which now states on line 1.9, in the Bemidji area rather than Bemidji State University, and at no cost to the scholarship program. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. To the bill, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moe, or this could be to Chief Visner, too. I know the Office of Legislative Auditor came out with a report and chided the Department of Education, where the scholarship program formerly was housed, or still is housed, about the program and the accountability. And I'm wondering to what extent that report will be followed through, and there will be accountability on how long these scholarships are extended and to whom these scholarships are awarded.
Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I would ask the Chair's permission to let the other testifiers say a couple of words. And
Mr. Chair, or Representative Moe, let's do that, and then perhaps they will answer Representative Erickson's question.
And if the question remains, then I'd be glad to respond.
Okay, let's go ahead. Welcome, Ms. Visner. Please restate your name for the tape.
Thank you very much. My name is Irma Visner. I'm tribal chairwoman of the White Earth Tribe, located in northwestern Minnesota. And members of the committee and Madam Chair, I thank you for this opportunity, and Senator Moe, I strongly support the legislation that has been proposed here to move the Office of American Indian Scholarship Programs from the Roseville office to the Bemidji area, where it will be more accessible to the students of the White Earth Tribe. Accessibility is very important, and following that is also the expedition of services and the accessibility of someone to talk to, which I believe is a good investment to have a staff person there to work with our students. As you know, the disparity in post-secondary education is very glaring, and many of our students do not receive the adequate financial aid, nor do they receive services that is appropriate for our students. So I strongly support the legislation as proposed, and ask for your passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the next testifier, please state your name.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Cindy Peterson. I'm the Director of the American Indian Student Service Program at Augsburg College, where I've served in that capacity for 12 years. I've worked in Indian education for 21 years. I'm also in support of this bill. The students that I deal with primarily are urban students, but their tribal affiliation is in the northern part of the state for the most part. And I understand how important it is for them to have access to an office where they can walk in and talk to somebody about their financial aid concerns. From my perspective, the program was running more smoothly when it was a separate function and located in the northern part of the state.
Thank you very much. Representative Erickson, did that answer your question?
No, Madam Chair, it doesn't, but I'll talk to Susan Hickard to make sure that, you know, this chiding of the Department of Education now does not transfer to her office, because it is important that we have accountability for these scholarships and for all scholarships.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, and I'm sure if you hear anything interesting from Ms. Hickard, we'd all like to hear it as well. Representative McFarland.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Representative Moe, we heard this in higher ed, I think it was just earlier this week. I don't recall that we were going to remove any, I mean, I thought we were still going to have an office in the St. Paul area. Did I not remember that right?
Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, there is, the Department of Higher Education will be responsible for the administration of the scholarship program. We've made it very clear that we would like to have access to the Indian Scholarship Program here in the Twin Cities as well, as they have access, provide access to the other scholarship programs that are administered in the state of Minnesota. I would just assume that they would do that. I mean, the ideal case scenario is a staff person in near South Minneapolis or something else. But again, if to allow for accountability in the scholarship delivery, we would allow them to figure out the best way to administer the program that way.
Okay. Just to follow, I guess my concern was for the at least 1,300 students that are in this Twin Cities area, too, that they should also be served well.
Of course.
Okay. Thank you. Any testimony for or against in the audience?
Two other notes quickly.
Representative Moe, this is your final word because there's no questions and no testifiers.
Okay. Chairman Lisi of the Boys Fort Indian Reservation is the president of the Indian Affairs Council, and just would like the committee to know he's not able to be here, but the Indian Affairs Council does support this as well. And the Gloria Kibble, the interim director of school choice, is right here. And if you just want to say briefly,
very, very briefly. Welcome and state your name, and you got like no more than a minute.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Education has, we have no, we're neutral on this bill.
Thank you. That was great. All right, Rep. Moe, final word or not?
Appreciate the committee support. Thank you.
Representative, House File 1383 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Rep. Moe and all. All right, Rep. Hornstein, you can come up, but I'm going to do my three bills from here just in case we run out of time because I need to get mine passed, and I will move the first one, House File 1564, be recommended for possible include or be laid over. No, this one has to be passed. I'm not used to passing bills in this committee. House File 1564, I move that it pass and be re-referred to Education Finance with further recommendation for re-referral to the Ways and Means Committee. And I'm going to call on Mr. Crow just to quickly explain this bill.
Chair and members, we had a situation with forecast appropriation in the special ed area that raised the possibility that we would have shortfalls in special education from one year to the next, or have declining revenue in special education, which would cause maintenance of effort problems for the state. So this basically allows for movement of funds in order to make sure that we continue to meet our maintenance of effort requirements in special ed.
Mainly a technical bill. Any questions?
I have one.
Any testimony? Is there any testimony first? Okay, Rep. McFarland.
I'm just, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering why fiscal year 2010.
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, this actually came out of the governor's bill, and it was covered from 08 to 09 because of the increases in his bill. We could change that effective date if you want. No, it's fine.
Find the way that. Okay. All in favor, say for House File 1564 to be passed and re-referred to Ed Finance with re-referral to Ways and Means. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. House File, I will move House File 2191, recommended to pass and re-refer to Ed Finance with further recommendation for re-referral to Finance. Mr. Crow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill provides the funding for the Telecommunications Internet Access Equity Aid. It funds it at the full level, at the unprorated level for the fiscal years 08 and 09.
Any questions on this one? Any testimony? All in favor of House File 291? 2291, thank you. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And I would move House File 2245, recommended to pass and re-referred to Ed Finance with re-referral, or to be placed then on the general register. Strom.
Madam Chair, this bill is technical in that it only corrects the outdated definition of general education revenue.
Okay, any questions? Any testimony? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Motion prevails. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the committee. Mm-hmm. I will move that House File 2011 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I really appreciate your taking this bill on such a busy day. I am very, very proud to be supporting this. We've talked a lot this year. One of the themes has been narrowing the achievement gap, but here we have a program that works at the grassroots level, involving the community, particularly on the north side, that has really proven measurable results to narrow the achievement gap, to involve the community, to involve students, parents, and schools. I can't say enough about how wonderful this program is, and of course we have people who are directly involved in it that can tell you better than I can. So I'd like to just call on T.C. Vidiaco, the executive director of the We Win Institute, to just give you a very brief overview of their program. Then we have a couple of participants. It'll be quick, Madam Chair, and we'd be happy to ask questions after everyone's done testifying.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Welcome, Ms. Is it Vidiaco?
Vidiaco.
Vidiaco. Okay, very good. Welcome, and please restate your name.
Titi Layo Vidiaco. People call me Titi for short. Mm-hmm. I'm the executive director of We Win Institute, and thank you so much for having us here today. I'm a licensed teacher that went out of the classroom to create a program that focused specifically on children that were having the greatest difficulties being successful academically and socially. And we can see across the board in Minnesota that who's on the top of that list are African American children. And what the schools primarily do is that they give us children to work with that they have had the least successes with, and we help them in terms of turning that around. And we do it with a program called Rites of Passage, and our Rites of Passage uses African history and culture as a way to assist our children in reading and writing specifically, and we help them in terms of steps and methods by which to be strong, determined men and women. We've been doing Rites of Passage with the Minneapolis Public Schools since 1998, and we are at Jordan Park Community School presently, and I'll just tell you to give you an example of some results that we've had. Last year, our program at Anderson Open, we had a 63% reduction in absences, 67% reduction in suspensions, and a 91% reduction in tardiness. We know what it takes in terms of helping our children to be successful. We need your support in terms of expanding what we do to as many of our children as possible. And what I would like to do, because I know that the time is limited, I would like to introduce you to one of our parents and one of the students in our program that also resided in North Minneapolis.
All right, why don't we have them come up and get all the testimony in. Welcome, and whichever one is going first, please state your name for the record.
My name is Deirdre Hollis-Williams, and not only am I a parent, but I also work for the Minneapolis Public Schools in the SPAN department with children that are expected not to do well. And I just would like to say that this program has been a very good program for both the SPAN program and for my children. My children are introverts, which didn't talk a lot to anybody, or their grades weren't as well as they are this year. But this year my kids are on the B and A honor roll. The kids from our program, I believe that when they begin to know who they are, or because they now know who they are, their grades have improved, their behaviors have improved, their attitudes have improved. So I believe that this is an outstanding program, and it is well needed in our community, because the children need to know who they are so that they can be whatever they're going to be. It helps them out a lot.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. And if you could welcome and state your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Teacher Howard, and I'm a member of We Win Institute. I'm in eighth grade. We Win has helped me be a leader. It has helped me, come together with my friends. When I was in sixth and seventh grade, I was not on the honor roll. Since I went to Jordan Park, I have been on the honor roll first and second quarter. Win has helped me achieve my goals. It has helped me, like, be in the place that I am. I was asked to be on student council because I'm a leader to my school, and little kids, I like, when I go past them, like, walking in the hallways and stuff, I don't be loud and stuff, so I'm not a bad person, so I think we would just say.
Congratulations on being on the honor roll and being a wonderful role model for the younger children. Any questions? Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is what grades does this include? We know it includes 8th grade, but what other grades does this include?
6th, 7th, and 8th.
Any other questions? Any testimony for or against the bill from the audience? Okay, thank you very much. House File 2011 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. And members, before we adjourn, Representative Morrow, did you have a motion to make?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move that we move House File 1424 to be referred to the Higher Ed Committee. We heard this bill. Ed Finance. This bill was brought to us by Representative Paulson, who's not here to make the motion on his own. This was on the world languages, and there was a component of a funding request for the MINSCU system for teacher education in world languages. And so it's been brought to my attention that that bill needs to move, and Representative Paulson would like me to make that motion.
Thank you. Representative Morrow moves in the absence, and Representative Paulson isn't even on this committee, that House File 1424 be re-referred to Ed Finance and then for possible travel then to the Higher Ed Committee. So any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and members, the meeting is adjourned.